I rely, and I'm just going to say this for me. If my response to an officer is because I'm a lawyer and that's why I said so.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Then it's not making sense. Now, I will admit, is there a part of being a trial attorney? Yeah, I have to walk into a room and tell 12 people, forget what that guy said. I'm right. He's wrong. Right? That's the job. But I think thinking that everyone is against me is not the case, right? You don't know how many times I'm going over my opening with my affiants. Does this make sense? Do you like the way this is phrased? Did they go to law school? No. Are they speech majors? No. Do they listen to the same facts I listen to over and over and over and live and breathe this case? Absolutely. So tell me, what do you think of it? Or cross-examination, I turn over, do you have anything else? It takes 2 seconds. Maybe they don't. I don't expect them to. They don't have to. But maybe they do. Maybe they have something that's helpful. So I think changing that mind shift that prosecutors are over here, law enforcement is over here.
You got to be on the same team.
We are.
Hey, guys, if you missed out on the last conference in Nashville, Tennessee, you don't want to miss out on the next one. It's April 28th through May 3rd, Orlando, Florida, the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center. You made a mistake missing the last one. You don't want that to happen again on this one. 5 days of some of the best training you're ever going to experience packed into one event. We have an early bird special right now, $50 off. Use 24 early bird on our website, streetcop.com. Look for the conference, click the link, register today. If you want to get significantly better at this profession in 5 days, don't dare miss out on the 2024 Street Cop Conference. 111,
Street Cop.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and we have with us today somebody who drove 2.5 hours with her husband to be here, a prosecutor from Pennsylvania. I don't know if I can say where and what and how much information we can give out, so I'll leave that up to you, but I appreciate you taking the time to come here. We're gonna have a good conversation today and, you know, really trying to improve the bond and the relationship between prosecutors and police officers.
Awesome. Happy to be here. So my name's Angela Sferazza. Right now, I'm a deputy attorney general in Pennsylvania. I'm in our child pred unit. Previous to that, I was an assistant district attorney in Luzerne County for about 9 years. So my legal life is prosecution. That's why I'm very passionate about law enforcement, prosecutors being able to have a good conversation.
I think that it's very admirable that somebody, you know, will choose prosecution because of the purpose behind it. I could tell when you come in that it wasn't just your only option, that you chose it because it meant something to you. That's what I feel like.
Chose me. I really do. When I came out of law school, it was one of those find a job immediately. The market was saturated. I got a job at a bankruptcy firm. I hated it.
Oh, yeah. It's tough.
I hated everything about it. I didn't feel a connection to the material. I didn't feel a connection to the way it was presented. I quit. After I found out I passed the bar, I went home. I think I've said this before. I felt like a failure. Mm-hmm. You know, you put in all this schooling, you come home and you have nothing. And I came home. I clerked for a judge who had a big homicide trial and he was doing criminal law. He said, you can come intern with me, see if you like it. I loved it. He offered me a job as like a tip staff, the person who says all rise. I said, OK, I don't care that I'm a lawyer. I'm taking this job. I'm interested in it. Luzerne County DA's office was hiring. I went down to interview. They didn't hire me. I went in and I said, why didn't you hire me? Well, you don't have enough experience. God works in mysterious ways. The person they hired didn't end up taking it. They called me back in and that was it. That was the bug. Prosecution was a totally different connection to the law than I had felt when I was doing bankruptcy.
What motivated you to reach out to us and drive 2.5 hours to come on this show?
So I recently did a podcast that was just in general about the law and finding my place and things like that. I teach at our police academy. I'm on the board for MOPEC, who I help draft our legal updates in Pennsylvania. And I'm on the board for Camp Cadet. I'm very passionate about law enforcement. If we do things right, every single case that is filed by law enforcement, we should win at trial, right? Theoretically. If you pick the right charges and you don't lie in your affidavits, which no one should be doing, we should win every trial. Obviously, we don't. Obviously, we lose a lot of cases. I think one of the biggest reasons that happens is we lack communication.
Mm-hmm.
If you're telling me, hey, Ange, I stopped this car and this is why, and I don't understand exactly why you did it, how am I supposed to articulate that to a judge or a jury? How am I supposed to take your three-dimensional scenario that you lived in and you were in and you're having all these thoughts and your brain's working in a different way than my jurors, how am I supposed to take that from a report and get up there and tell them to believe you, follow you, and think the way you thought?
You know, as you're talking about this, I can certainly point out to one thing, and I guess it's my job to point out the problems in order to find a solution. So I think any solution we come up with, we first always have to acknowledge what the problem is.
Yeah.
And so I could tell you that I know for a fact that some of these major things about the communication, namely when we're trying to communicate to prosecutors and through our reports, is something that can be fixed. And they can be fixed at a very, very, you know, beginner level of the police academy. But to be honest with you, there is really no time spent on report writing in police academies. And if there is, usually it's grammatical. And it has to do more of a English literature, 10th grade. I'm going to write a 5-page or 10-page, what you call a term paper, for your high school teacher for the first half of your senior year, or, you know, whatever, junior year, or whatever it may be, sophomore year. And so I think people don't realize what a report should look like and what are the details that are important. And I think that also ties back into, if they don't know what's important, how do they know what to write?
Yeah.
So we send our cops into the field, essentially, almost from everywhere, with no knowledge of how this is supposed to look. I can tell you one time that I was really reprimanded significantly by one of our prosecutors. I'd been driving behind a car. I was new. They were smoking weed in the car at the time. This is 15 years ago. So I stopped the car. And maybe an arrest or two was made out of it, small amount of marijuana. Unfortunately, at that time in New Jersey, we had the weed and seed program, so the Attorney General guideline dictated that we must make an arrest.
Mm-hmm.
There were only two scenarios that you couldn't make an arrest for. So we weren't able to, like, essentially, when I was a cop in D.C., we could do something called, like, and I'll make it surface level so people understand, like, hey, send me a time and alarm or an incident number and a time generated number, a CAD number, for narcotics, marijuana, no arrest. So we could take stuff at our discretion because the court system was so inundated and so flooded and so overwhelmed that they allowed the police officers up to a certain degree and criteria to make assessments in the field to not prosecute.
Yeah.
And we couldn't do that in New Jersey. You had to make an arrest. As a matter of fact, you could look at serious consequences if you didn't. So I would tell people, like, hey, man, I am so sorry. I know how insignificant this is. You made this appear like it was so much more than it was going to be, but I have to take action on it because to not do so would jeopardize my career. And so I would argue that. I'm like, you know, why are we not, you know, we're talking about marijuana being so insignificant before it was legal. You know, why are we not changing this guideline? Why are we not going to this guideline and now giving us this? What a solution this would be. We don't have to arrest for anything less than 4 ounces a week. You know what I mean? It's just a report generated. We take it, we put it in for destruction. Almost like a no bill on the scene.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that I remember asking a prosecutor in the police academy, I was like, hey, if we find weed, can we just toss it out? You know, and he was like, why would you do that? I'm like, you know, you get a kid on the side of the road, you don't want to ruin his life. He's 19. He's just merely smoking weed. Can we just throw it out? And like, he's like, I'm not tracking. He just couldn't understand what I was saying.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, you're a cop. You get a kid, he's got a bag of weed on him, right? 19 years old, you don't want to ruin his life over a fucking dime bag.
Yeah.
A gram or 2 grams of weed. What do we do? Why wouldn't you make the arrest? This went on, like, and you could ask, you know, the 37 guys that were in my academy class. He just couldn't figure out what I was trying to say. And so he could not give us guidance because I don't think that he even read the AG guidelines.
Yeah.
Because I would have said, knowing that AG guideline, hey, there's a weed and seed program. There are two scenarios where you don't have to. And one's, I would jeopardize like a criminal investigation, and the other one is there are public emergencies happening.
Yeah.
So there's an active shooter. You can't be arresting somebody for a fucking ounce of weed.
You're staying there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we had a when we had Hurricane Katrina. No, we were not Katrina. I'm sorry. I'm fucking up. We had what do we have? Irene. What do we have in Jersey?
Oh, I don't even know off the top of my head.
Hurricane Irene.
Once you find Sandy. It, there you go. Oh, see.
Yeah. So we had Hurricane Sandy, and you know, unfortunately, people during this major state of affairs that we were dealing with. I mean, it's the only time in my whole career that I actually felt genuinely scared.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know what the fuck we were going to do because we lost everything. and we could not drive to anybody. It was a really, really dangerous moment. And, you know, there were things that were happening that were just like, typically, we'd arrest you. We cannot today because we're still getting calls for service. But we, like, were, it was so crazy where I worked, because where I worked, we were on the water.
Okay.
We were literally on the Atlantic, that we would go in for like a rescue, and the way we went in would no longer be accessible on the way out within like 5 minutes. That's how nutty it got. And so we were having to go like almost trial and error. And you had to have been from there to know how to navigate through other towns. So fortunately, yeah. If I grew up where I worked, I knew a lot about the towns that surrounded us outside of our jurisdiction. And so I would, I just knew how to get back, but how to go like really like this way, come all the way around this way, like, and just hitting these dead ends of like, oh fuck, there's a ton of water here. Water didn't subside for days. Wild.
How did that affect you after the fact that you had to kind of adapt the hierarchy in your brain of how you were dealing with calls? Did it change the way you dealt with calls after the hurricane?
No, once it was done, we back to business as usual, but it wasn't done for about 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
But what I unfortunately saw post Hurricane Sandy was the worst behavior I've ever seen in my life. There wasn't a lot of good behavior, and I was in the middle of it. There was a lot of selfishness. People just, the discomfort or feeling the discomfort was so overwhelming for these first generation, you know, these first world people.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, I'm just, I couldn't believe how brash and bold they were and how selfish people were.
And how quickly it devolved to that. Yeah.
Like how much of a piece of shit everybody became. I'm not saying there weren't kindness and acts of kindness, but it was very selfish. But with that being said, I don't need to go on a rant.
No, but I think it's interesting because one of the things that our average juror or the average person doesn't realize is how people respond to stress. Most people, they hey neighbor their friends and every, you know, John seems like a nice guy. He waves at me when I wave. When John gets a call that the police are coming to their house because he hit his wife, he's not the same nice guy. You, obviously, when we're talking about Hurricane Sandy, we're talking about people in extreme stressors, right? They don't have resources. You're seeing the worst of people coming out in those extreme conditions. I think law enforcement sees a lot of people on their worst day.
Yes.
And me being able to communicate that to a juror is very different than a defense attorney putting you in a box and saying, well, when you answered, you knocked on the door very loudly and you only waited 4 seconds before you screamed police. Well, if I ask my officer, you know, why'd you only wait 4 seconds? Well, I hear somebody in there screaming and I hear this going on and this is what's going through my head. And it's my responsibility to make sure the person inside who called 911 is safe. Even the potential defendant is safe. Make sure I'm safe.
Mm-hmm.
I think people rely on police officers in times of stress. So we need to get better at hearing from them what that actually looks like.
Well, I think that we're not taught enough humanity.
I agree with that.
And so I think it's our job to strike the chords in the hearts of law enforcement in this country to have humanity. And I was going to say this earlier, and I didn't go there yet, but there's a video of a police officer in Seattle who, I don't know if you saw this yet on body-worn camera, makes light and jokes of a girl who was killed in a crosswalk by a Seattle police car, 26-year-old.
I did not see that.
It's disturbing, and it paints a bad picture for law enforcement. And I've taken a position to be non-judgmental. And so somebody asked me, you know, what's your thoughts on this? And I appreciate that Street Cop addresses things like this. I said, first of all, I'm in no position to address this. Now, if I was her family, I'd be fucking livid. I could tell you that right now. But I also have to understand and at least stop for a second and say, what caused this?
Why did
this guy
act?
Is this guy really this guy? And so that's what I'd want to know.
Yeah.
And I honestly, I said it on the last podcast we recorded. I know that Zach Bryan, that the country singer?
Yeah, I think so.
Right? Was arrested recently. And before the national FOP or national order of police, whoever made a statement accepting his apology, which he did publicly, said it, I said it on here. But it's pre-recorded, so it's going to be coming out 2 weeks later. Because, man, the last thing I want to do is make a mistake because I'm going through some shit and then have everybody just turn their back on me for one boo-boo. And I just can't emphasize that enough to people. So if you're asking me that I should literally go on a platform and start criticizing this man's remarks, I will tell you this. I'm not happy about it, but it doesn't mean I'm mad at this guy. I just want to know why. Why did, like, that's it. And if this man comes out and is apologetic and expresses how he ended up being on that, you know, it's like anything else, man. It's like, what is the backstory behind it? Why is he acting like this? There's got to be a reason. And I think a lot of that is we don't spend enough time teaching humanity when we have the opportunity to do so.
And right now we're in this place that it's, I think we have kind of a headhunter culture, right? I'm going to cancel this person. I'm offended on behalf of this person, right? So we can't even have a dialogue.
Happens to me.
I'm not even the one offended, right? And we have no conversation about, okay, if we can all agree that we don't like this behavior, what's the way back and what's the education after it? Because I don't think we put any conversation into that. And since when did we become a throw people away culture?
That's right? Crazy.
That we're going to immediately, we're going to applaud the people that can headhunt you and find something you said when you were 15 years old, right? And we're going to put that up in public square and we're going to talk about how horrible you are. And we're not going to have any conversation about how we educate you or how that changes. I was ignorant when I went to college. I was from a little Italian town, had a wonderful family. So I didn't have bad interactions with anyone. And I went to college in Manhattan, in New York City. I didn't know what I didn't know. Like, ignorant in the truest sense of the word. Didn't know what I didn't know. My friends were kind enough to take the time to have conversations with me and educate me. Same way when I started in the DA's office. I was 26 years old.
Yeah, your baby.
I didn't know what I didn't know.
You didn't know life.
I had a law degree. Great. I have a law degree. I don't know what weed smells like. I don't know the signs of intoxication. I don't know how you would handle a domestic. I know none of those things. I had law enforcement officers that were willing to educate me. If they said, you said something we didn't like, Spiraza, we're not dealing with you as a prosecutor, we're done. I wouldn't be sitting here mm-hmm. as a deputy attorney general. So I think we need to focus more as a society on how we're educating people and bringing them back, and maybe less on stringing them up.
Think about the trust that I had my coworkers, especially new ones, where they knew that if they had an embarrassing question, they can come to me and ask. And I can tell you this one time, we had a girl who I field trained. She was working off duty at one of the high schools, and she knew I was working. She said, hey, can you come here? I said, sure. She goes, I just got to show you something. I have a question for you. And she knew she couldn't ask anybody else. She came to my car, and she pulled weed out of her pockets. And she said, is this weed? She'd been on the job for like a year. And I said, it is, because I didn't know. I said, it's okay. I'm glad you called me. I will never tell anybody.
Yeah.
So that's why I called you. And to think that we have done such a failed job at even getting this police officer prepared.
Yeah.
Like, it's this constant thing where we're so scared as cops to say, I don't know. And there's a, such an opportunity at the beginner level to, you know, to essentially address these things that we know are going to be issues in the future. And I teach this. I taught a class last week, an all-female class. So I had to fill in for Heather Glogolich, whose friend passed away. She was murdered, and she had to go through her services. So I said, I'll take care of this class. We'll do something different for this group of people. And it was an all-female class. And I never treat anybody in this industry differently because of, like, you're a cop, you're a cop.
Yeah.
So you're going to hear the foul mouth of me. You're going to hear the compassion, how I feel about you, in the sense of, like, there's so much love for me to you, that you're going to know that there's literally, I don't see you as any other different. I don't care what you look like. You're one of me. You're one of us. And, you know, I just kept repeating to them, like, you know, what an opportunity we have when we're new to train and avoid these things. Like, did anybody tell you at the academy what to do when you encounter a First Amendment auditor? Like, we know this is inevitability as you as police officer. Like, why are we not at least taking an hour to discuss it in the fucking 24, 20, 22, 16, 12 weeks of you being at a training academy? And we know that you're probably never going to testify on the nomenclature of an asp baton or whatever, a collapsible, I don't want to say asp, a collapsible baton. You'll never testify you're not an expert witness on the hydraulic needle effect that a pepper spray can cause on the retina of an eyeball. Yet we spend time on that. But mm-hmm. I can guarantee you that you're going to run into scenarios of, like, what do I do for an extraction if I run into a situation like this? Why don't we spend a little more time on, like, a choking kit or CPR? Because inevitably you're going to be doing CPR and deal with a choking kit. And I got to tell you, the amount of medical training that you've received is almost just checking a box.
Mm-hmm.
Important stuff. What are we not? Why are we not talking about when we can compel identification? How am I watching on social media platforms senior patrol officers still thinking they can compel identification because somebody's merely detained in a vehicle as a passenger, as a circumstance of the driver being detained?
Yep.
You know, and it's wild. And you watch these videos and you got people who know the law better than these fucking cops do. And I look at those videos and I'm not like, oh, okay, like these cops should have known better. I'm like, they didn't teach them. I know who you are. There's no judgment. Right? I'm sure you're embarrassed. They didn't teach you.
And we don't, I mean, I don't know about your, so our police academy does at the end of everything, and this is what I teach, in-court testimony. They do a tiny mm-hmm. little thing for in-court testimony. I don't know how we're not teaching in-court testimony constantly. Every time you're doing a scenario, why are we not? Do you as a patrol officer want the first time that you're on the stand and someone ruffles your feathers as defense attorney be, because let's think about it, what goes to trial?
DWIs.
And the iffy stuff, right? Right now, I think resisting arrests go to trial. Or let's say you're the on duty and there's a rape or there's a murder and you're the person who finds the body and you're the initial response.
Yeah, your major crime. You know, so when we have classes, I'm like, you know, how many people have actually sat on trial in here before? I'm like, besides the major crime detectives in here.
Yeah.
Because when somebody's looking at a plea agreement of 25 years to life versus 50 to life on a possible trial, they're going to go for it, especially if they're like 50, 60
Absolutely.
Years old, right? So those guys are going to trial a lot, you know, and so. What about the average patrolman? You're going to go to trial on a DWI.
Yeah.
And that's because there is so many semantics and moving parts of DWI that if you get an expert, and you're probably going to run into, you're inevitably, as a patrol officer, going to have to arrest somebody for DWI. It's inevitable.
Yeah.
It's going to happen. If you're not looking for it, somebody's going to hit something, you're going to show up, they're going to be drunk, or someone, and you're going to have to make the arrest.
And or you're going to be somebody that's there. Who wants their first time on the stand? Be when there's actually stakes. Like, why are we not doing this in training? You know, bleed in here so you don't bleed out there. Why are we not finding out that if I piss you off, you attack me, right? I've had cadets who, that's their response. I could tell them that sign says street cop and they're so mad at me that they'll tell me it doesn't say it because they see red. If you know it, then you know to watch for it. Why are we finding out the first time when you're on the stand? Or if you fall into a yes hole, right? Defense attorneys that just hammer you with questions, and you just start going yes, because you break down, because you think, I did what I had to do on direct, I don't have to do anything on cross. It's lost on me as to why we don't go over that repeatedly.
You know, I haven't had time to write what it should be yet, but that is one of my projects that I have on my board of things to do. And so my role here plays a little differently. And that'll be my project. Because I hate to just be the guy that criticizes it all. And I have given some direction and advice, but I do believe that I need to rewrite the entire program for them and pass it around to the 50 plus instructors at this company, have them get eyes on it, make suggestions, maybe even put it into our groups of 100,000 followers, have them make suggestions and then show up and say, here's what we think the solution is. And the reality is, and this is the truth, the solution is, people may not like to hear this, most of the police academy is going to have to go digital. And I'll tell you why. You will never, if we are trying to teach these people, in these recruits, these cadets, from a person who knows what they're talking about, there are not many people who know what they're talking about. So you will have to go to the experts and learn from them if you want them to be taught right.
Yep.
And so I understand the constraints of these police academies and the resources that are available to them. You will have to have a digital product where your academy will be not virtual from home. Like you can still, you know, I still think that there's an element. Do I think there needs to be drill instruction? No, I don't. Do I think there needs to be situations where you're going to have to teach people about how much they have and what they can do under stress? Yes, but I don't think you need a guy in a Sam Brown hat screaming in your fucking face to get you accustomed to extreme stress. And the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, 20 years ago when I went, did a pretty good job at not having DI work, but also encompassing a scenario where they can put you through high stress situations and you encounter things. Probably could have done a little bit better, but overall, I think they did the best job.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they're doing differently in the mindset. I think like FLETC has a collaboration of people that are the best, the best. I think these people, because if you go on like usajobs.gov, they'll have openings for that. So you'll have the best like firearms guys going there. You have the best guys at this because they know they can go teach federal police officers. Where I think more locals, like, hey, you know, you're certified in methods of instruction or something like this. You've got the state cert that you went through the 60-hour program. And you come in here and just like plug the fucking USB drive in and just teach me about handcuffing.
Well, or listen, you're a hammer. You have all these interdiction arrests. You live this. Well, class is going to be taught between 8 to 4. So if you're working a regular shift, you're not teaching class. I teach in-court testimony because it's the only thing I can teach with my schedule because it's at the end. So I see these cadets when they're at the end, right about to graduate. And listen, I love the fact that we do something on in-court testimony, but I'd love to be up there teaching in-court testimony when they're teaching anything about search and seizure or ways to articulate. Can I do that? No, because I'm in trial constantly. So not to toot my own horn, but I would want someone like me teaching in-court testimony. Because I'm in trial every single month.
You're getting good at it. And you know, when you started that stuff, probably intimidating.
Absolutely.
To go sit down at trial. But you've become accustomed to it. You've gotten good at it.
And like, I tell this story. So I had a trial. This woman beats her baby.
Oof.
And there's another guy there. He's there smoking weed. She tells him to leave the house, right? So defense starts the trial with, don't hold it against me that I'm young and I'm a female attorney and blah, blah, blah. She's older than me at the time. And I'm sitting there like, I'm not doing this. We're not going this way. So we stick to our trial. We go through everything. Finally, we get to a point that my detective is on and I've put him on numerous times before. So I know how he testifies. He's doing great. He's slaying her. He's sticking to everything. He's saying, you know, in all the time we interviewed this woman, she doesn't once ask how her kid is, all the things you would want. So they finally find this guy who leaves, and he had some misdemeanor unauthorized use warrant. And defense says to him, the defense attorney says, did you take him in on that warrant or was that below your pay grade? Stop. We have two possible things that could happen. My detective, who's been calm, cool, and collected and done great, can yell at her, this person who has been telling the jury, don't hold it against me, taking this sheepish mentality. And he looks like a dick. Right. And that becomes maybe what's sticking in the heads of my jurors. Or he can look whipped by her by saying, no, I didn't, blah, blah. He knew me. I got up and I objected. That's the way you get out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Would I have known that if he and I hadn't been on the stand so many times before? No. But he knew I got up. I objection, argumentative. She's badgering my witness. We get past that remark that has nothing to do with the testimony. We get back to my detective's testimony, and she hasn't colored him in any possible way. Being in it is what makes you learn it to teach it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those little nuanced things. But like you said, if you can't have those people doing the teaching, what ends up getting taught? Here's the PowerPoints.
Mm. So good.
We'll
need somebody like you as we develop. So we have Street Cop University coming out. And so right now, I can't spend a lot of time, 100% of the time, trying to fix the cadet recruit level thing yet. I have to try to work on one battle at a time. And the battle we're working on now is making sure the digital product we have provides the training for police officers that they actually need.
Yeah.
And so while people may not like a digital product, I don't think there's any reason why we can't achieve that goal of really getting some top-notch training out in a digital product, which we do already. This is a subscription product, which I think is a real wonderful solution for a lot of people. I think everybody's going to be friggin' nuts about it, really. Because I spend time on YouTube nonstop. Ange, I'm on YouTube constantly. Like, I have YouTube Premium so I can work out and listen to, and I'll give credit where credit's due. You don't know who Alex Hormozi is, which I don't anticipate a lot of people do. This is a guy who's 32. He's a newcomer in the game of being more open as a business savant. And he's amazing.
Real recognizes real, right? You pick, that's what I say all the time. Like when we're putting people on the stand, real recognizes real. I don't expect you to say you did everything exactly the way that you would do it if you could look at it again.
Hindsight 2020 is a crazy thing. I don't even like the word hindsight 2020. I think it's mistakes promote growth.
But when you're real and honest about why you did what you did and where it came from, and we talked before about having the right moral compass, real recognizes real. That's what I want from law enforcement. That's what I want from my friends. That's what I want from the content that I imbibe, like you're talking about. You want somebody that speaks to you. I think that makes sense.
Yeah. I have crazy ADHD. I've taken like the online test and it's like basically it's like, you're fucked. But I have to also say that I don't like calling it something. And I want to let everybody know out there, if you have ADHD, you are literally so blessed. I think you should count your lucky stars and be thankful you're one of the chosen ones. And I'll elaborate to why in a second. But let me just rewind a little bit where Godin recently talked about this on this podcast episode. It's Tim Ferriss. He wrote, also another New York Times bestselling author. Tim has one of the top podcasts in the business world, probably top 25. And he talked about in-person courses versus online and how they both can do the same thing. And in both scenarios, you may see people on their phones. And it has nothing to do with the forum. It has to do with the content and the instructor.
Yeah.
So that actually sparked thoughts and I sent over like a thing. We're going to start doing more content on 5 things to not do when you're an instructor. 5 things to acknowledge when you're an instructor, when you're trying to keep people. 5 things to do. But to go back to this, I've talked about this in the past. I'm in a mastermind group. I joined it. It's very expensive. So I drink my own Kool-Aid. When I tell people, you should invest in this company, in 5 or 6 classes, you'll have a different career. I invest 25-fold of what I suggest you should invest here every year. That's an annual subscription. I'm fortunate enough to be able to afford that. But why I won't cancel that is because of what I get to have access to these people. Now, these people are significantly more successful than me. And I guess success is something that is subjective.
I would agree with that.
But when we talk about money, they're there. And I think they, oddly enough, it's so funny, I was talking to Tim, who's one of the co-founders of it. He's like, bro, they love you. I'm like, well, I just bring a different element to the table. And my element is not, you know, what they can bring. They know digital marketing better than anybody. I don't. But I bring something different that they often, I think, feel refreshed about. But what I could tell you is the one thing that's constantly talked about when we have these big meetings, 85, 100 people, and we all agree that we all have crazy ADHD. All of us. Like, nobody there is like, nah, I don't have to. Like, yeah, it's like this commonality in this hierarchy of these top level producers and these really big thought leaders. Of like how, you hear Mark Cuban talk about it.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm a fucking slob. And there's a saying I like, if a cluttered desk reveals a thoughtful mind, what does a clean desk tell you about somebody? Yeah, like I think it's an Albert Einstein quote.
I like that.
Yeah. So, you know, we haven't gotten to anything what we're going to talk about.
That's okay. I think we're getting to important stuff.
Well, I think it all leads full circle back to some of the things that we need to begin to have conversations about. Humanity is such an important one, and leadership, which brings good humanity. I have said this many times. I think that you could spend more time in YouTube for cops and get more out of it on just some stuff that's about humanity, leadership, compassion, maybe knowing yourself more, self-growth, self-awareness, independence. I think the cops need to begin to be a little more independent outside of the social circles that we set them in, because it's so easy to just fit in.
Oh, absolutely.
And the question you have to ask yourself is, do you want to fit in? Do you think that the things that are being said are the things that reflect you or who you want to be? And so we never fit in, me and the probably 9 to 20 men and women that I worked with out of the 200 there, we just never fit in. But we all fit in with each other. And so that's the beautiful thing about this company, is that we know that we're by ourselves in some sense of how we see this profession. And so we also know that people took this profession because they needed a job.
Yep.
And maybe sometimes they found that they needed the job and then found calling and purpose, which is great. That does it for you. Most people come into it with the right state of mind. The question is, who's going to trick you into drinking their Kool-Aid?
And I think being comfortable with being uncomfortable, right? I think we have a problem in society today, the way that we look at law enforcement. It's a political issue, and it shouldn't be a political issue, in my opinion. But it's very easy, like you said. Like, my husband's a cop, so I'm going to hang around with cops, and then I'm not going to ever have to worry about being put in a situation that someone's going to say something that bothers me, so I need to figure out how I'm going to deal with it. That's one option. I don't think that's the best option. My jurors are not all cops, cop friends. I need to figure out how to get across, like we talked about before, if you can't find a flaw in the logic, good advice is good advice, right? If I'm putting a case on, and my case is, like I said, the facts are the facts and this is what we charged, then I should be able to give that information or relay that information, advocate it to any juror, no matter what their background. If I tell myself as a person in general, I'm only going to put myself around people who think exactly the way I do, they're never going to give me any pushback, I'm never going to have a discussion, how am I going to be an effective prosecutor? I'm not. And I'm a public servant, right? I am not only a deputy attorney general for people that I like or for people that make me comfortable. Same way cops don't get to call a 911 call and say, tell me their demographics before I decide I'm going to go to that call.
Tell me their political view.
Yeah. Tell me what's their thoughts on Game of Thrones.
I actually think cops do a really good job at being very neutral.
Absolutely.
And I think there's no better display of that when they had the BLM protests and the guy shot the other guy and who's the first people to run in. The cops who had the rocks thrown at them by the same guy earlier that day. And I think one of the most powerful things that we can rely on is just the truth.
Absolutely. The truth is a lion. Yeah. You don't have to defend it. You release it and it defends itself.
Yeah. So like you can show up somewhere and I think once I learned how to explain the truth to people, I remember, you know, I can tell you on many occasions, but one of my lines were like, police are merely a band-aid for this circumstance right now. And I don't even have answers for them. We won't be here tomorrow. So if this happens again, we're just a band-aid for the scenario. And people don't like that at times, but I think they at least respect.
Yeah, because it's true.
Truth sucks sometimes.
It does.
So, you know, I have to acknowledge the things that are truthful about me. I have to acknowledge my past to learn from it. But we also can't let the past determine who we are in the future. We all have things that we're unproud of. I mean, you can't secede from those things, improve and become a better person.
I like the concept of talking about truth, because let's say I'm putting you on the stand, right? And you and I are friends. And I say, hey, you did a great job. Awesome. We're going to do awesome. Everything's going to go great. And I do not prepare you for cross-examination. I do not prepare you for what's going to get under your skin. I know you have a temper, but I want you to stay happy and we're prepping for trial. And let's do this. I've done you a grave disservice because I've hidden the truth from you. Right. If I don't sit down and figure out exactly what the thing you're most afraid a defense attorney is going to ask you and how you're going to respond to it, if we can't have that open dialogue and have that truth, how the hell am I going to tell a jury that I know that what he did was the right thing to do and I know he responded correctly and I know he's testifying truthfully? Because I haven't been willing to have those conversations with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's huge. I think, you know, we're talking about truth in an open sense, right? In your everyday life, which is huge. Being genuine is huge. I think it bleeds over into the way you choose to practice and the way that, for me as a prosecutor, the way you ultimately testify, whether you're willing to face those truths or not.
I know why people run from the truth. Let's have some guesses, but it's the pain.
Yeah.
It's so easy to ignore the truth. And that's actually, I think, one of my strong points that I am so convicted on, the just living my life by the truth, that it rubs people the wrong way. And so I've had to learn how to soften the truth a little bit, but I certainly don't say the things I say with them being untrue. Fortunately, ruffles feathers.
Don't you think it also leads you to being with people that look for the truth and value it?
No question about it, but it certainly creates friction.
I could see that.
I am trying to keep cops alive. That's my number one thing. I'm trying to keep people alive. And so if you reverse engineer it, we have to look at why there are cops dying, apparent every single day, because nobody's ever taught them. So if nobody's ever taught them, we have to figure out how to reteach them. So when you're telling to the people who teach them now that you're killing people because you are not putting thought into how to reteach them, you're very offended because they're very prideful in what they do. When you're telling people that what you're saying is incorrect, what you've been saying for 20 years is incorrect, 40, 50, or 60 years, what you lived by, what you believe to be the truth is wrong. It creates a lot of friction.
And I mean, we talk about, and I'm obviously, a lot of my friends are police officers. My husband is a police officer. And I was very anti that when I started prosecuting, but he's a wonderful man.
I didn't know how this went down. You don't need to fucking tell me because, you know, just so we're clear, Angela, you're not the first prosecutor to end up with a cop.
I know.
This is a big thing. This happens all the fucking time.
When I started, I was adamant that I wasn't going to do that. There were people that did, and that was fine, but I wasn't going to confuse
my purpose. Let me just
start
with this. Was he one of your cops that you had to consult with?
No, not really.
Oh, no shit.
No, I was doing, so I was in our special victims unit, and I was the head of our major crimes unit. So I was doing special victims, crimes against kids, domestic violence, stuff like that. Death by drug delivery. I was the first one to charge it in Luzerne County. And homicide. He's got the dog. He's doing drug stuff. So I'm not really going to see him often. But we ended up having conversations about the stuff we're talking about now.
When did you guys first meet?
Oh, honey, when did we first meet? Probably when I was 26 years old. But we didn't date.
How old are you guys now, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 36.
Okay, it's 10 years later.
Yeah. But we both had a mentor that we liked. Our old director of the police academy was a former prosecutor. She met me at a training. She was like, "You're coming to teach for me." I said, "You know, what business do I have teaching anything?" She was like, "No, I know you're going to be good at this. And you rise to expectations." And that's what I did. I figured it out. He would call her separately for advice on things because she was one of those very active people. So she passed away very unexpectedly.
That's terrible.
And we had ourselves in this situation that I was used to going to her that, "Oh, I don't know if I agree with the administration. I'm just an ADA. What do I think about this?" And she was very true north. You know what's right. You do what's right.
That's cool.
You figure it out.
That's fantastic.
And she was that for him. So we saw each other at the funeral and the wake. And we end up in court one day. And he's cranked about something.
By the way, I just watched Wedding Crashers. So, you know, like the part where he's like, "Oh, funerals are where it's at." Remember that one with Will Ferrell's right? character?
Shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah, shooting fish. I just literally watched it like 2 days ago.
But he needed advice. And he saw me in court. He hearkened back to, he knew I was close with Marianne. So he called me. And we ended up in a conversation that we both hung up the phone. And I was like, "What the heck just happened there?" And because it was a candid conversation. It was a candid conversation about frustrations, about wanting to do the right thing, finding the way to do the right thing, and then the rest is history. But that's what ended up leading us to it. It was not, a long
cool.
night over a
and that's
a
how
case.
It happens, right? I don't think there's any right, wrong, or indifferent way of connecting with somebody and then recognizing that, and then eventually find yourself in a relationship with them. It's pretty wild.
And it's amazing because he never, we didn't get married, and he was like, "That was cute that you were a prosecutor and you're in trial constantly and you piss people off and you talk about your piles. When I'm in trial, it's like a beautiful mind. There's just things everywhere." I'll tell you a very good story. So we had a case, a woman said she was raped by a trooper.
Jesus Christ.
I come to find out she's completely lying. Like, I have videotape of the area. She misidentifies the trooper multiple times. We charge her with false reports, which I did not take lightly. I'm special victims prosecutor, right?
But that trooper was thrilled.
Oh.
I'm sure he was happy that
both troopers.
Yeah.
But I didn't take it lightly because I didn't want to deter victims. And it was very clear, you come into a DA's office and you say you're raped by a trooper. We stop everything. We have detectives, all these resources. I was like, there has to be some ramification. So we go into trial, and the way it plays out is she says she's going to testify. I finish my case in chief. So the next morning is going to be cross-examination. So I have a night before cross-examination and closing. And we're in my little house at the time, and I'm going through stuff, and Joe calls it. He's like, "I'm going to bed." I said, "Okay." So I get in the shower, I'm going through things. I start screaming because it comes to me once I stop thinking about it, the way that I can trap her. If she says this, I'm going to say that. If she says this, I'm going to say that. And I start screaming, and my Marine law enforcement husband is like, "What is going on? Who's in the house?" Like, he's worried he's going to have to shoot someone, and I'm, "Write this down. Write this down." And he, like a champ, did. And we were successful. She was convicted. If I didn't have him as a husband, I don't know if I would be able to have those same moments, that I can be too much or go too far.
Well, you're Italian.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm passionate about what I do. So there's no turning it off.
Right.
But he didn't meet me. We get married, and he's like, okay, now I would like a little Italian wife who's going
to
make me pasta.
Right, yeah, for sure he doesn't need to marry. He didn't date that person. He's not expecting that person.
So I'm very lucky that he's as supportive as he is in that regard.
Hey guys, follow us on all social media platforms to include Instagram, Twitter, Facebook group. We have so much information going on every single day, and we don't want you to miss out on any of that stuff. So check it out. Go give us a follow.
Let's just direct this conversation into kind of the topics that we wanted to discuss when you came in, and you want to talk about communication between police officers and prosecutors.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can elaborate some of the things that you're seeing that are problems that currently exist between communication of police officers and prosecutors.
Absolutely. So I think I mentioned earlier, you know, when I started, I was 26. I didn't know anything. First homicide I get, I ask my detective, take me to the scene. Because I was a second chair, so I wasn't called out to the scene when it happened. I ask him to take me to the scene. I ask him, I want to walk where my guy went. I want to go through everything. My detective did. He'd probably been to that scene 100 times, right? He probably knows that portion of Wilkes-Barre better than anybody. And he did. And I was able to learn. I could see that even though he took a longer route, the longer route he took was covered by trees. So if I have to explain it to a jury, or if I have to ask my detective, why are you not surprised he took a longer route even though he had just committed a crime? He can articulate it. So I think about that, and that follows me through my career. It's the reason I'm able to be successful in cases. I don't think those conversations are happening anymore. I think prosecutors are coming in and I'm the lawyer, you're the cop. These are the elements. Just put the elements on, be done. I think it's both sides' fault to some extent. I think if I come in with that attitude, why would you then say to me, no, we need to talk about this? And I think it's my job now that I've been doing this for 11 years. I read a ton of case law, obviously. The courts in Pennsylvania are zeroing in, right? We have a lot of traffic stop cases coming up, a lot of Rodriguez moment cases, and the courts are saying things like a de minimis violation is not de minimis. There's no such thing. As soon as that moment happens, you're done, and they want to really nitpick right when that second happens. Well, if cops communicated with me and that helped me understand to be a good prosecutor, I would like to communicate back with you. It's not just what the courts are saying it, but the way they're saying it is they're watching every single thing. And how do we not make bad case law? So I think one of the problems is we're not having these long conversations. Even the conversation we had before about your background, about what you want to do. I know if you're on the stand, I'm going to let someone talk to you if they want to go through your training and experience. Instead of going, oh man, this is going to bore the jury. I'm just going to get through it. No, I love it. I'm going to let a defense attorney ask you all about it because I know what's coming out of your mouth. Is it the elements of my case? Probably not. But did I learn it from having a conversation with you? Absolutely. So I think we have to have genuine conversations, and that's not happening right now.
I don't know if there's a fix to that. But what I can tell the law enforcement community is, maybe the fix to that is for you to display what it looks like to start. And I think people need to establish those communication channels. And I think administrations need to muster up the courage to go have tough conversations with prosecutors.
Yep.
People always say to me, you know, our prosecutor's not doing this, they're not doing that. What should we do? Your chief needs to go get involved. That's where you're going to find headway. You as a patrolman, in their mind, I almost don't even see you as a human being, but certainly an irrelevant person in the grand scheme of things. When we're trying to change things, I might see you as a human being in some sense, but insignificant in your push to establish change and trying to get all of us on the same page. And so it's going to be give and take with that. You know, your prosecutor is going to be, and it's frustrating. I hear it nonstop. A very frustrating industry to be in overall and in general. And just the fact that politics are so embedded in all of this really is at the core what the biggest problem is.
I would agree with that. I like what you said though about start the communication. Try to start what it is. When I talk to police officers, I say all the time, if you haven't testified before, you're not helping me as a prosecutor by not telling me that you haven't testified before, right? You're not doing me a favor like, oh, Angela's going to feel more confident because I didn't tell her this is my first time testifying. I'd rather know.
Yeah.
You tell me where the bombs are so that I can navigate you through them. I think that that basic trust and understanding, and I do think there has to be more of a reach out from your local DA's office or your attorney general's office because it does get lost. I don't see what's happening on the street, right? I have a badge. I don't wear a badge and I don't get shot at. That just doesn't happen. So if you're not telling me, hey, Ange, when I come up to a car, burnt marijuana smells different than vaped marijuana. You don't tell me that. How do I know to articulate to a judge? And then when we're talking about case law and even laws that we're enacting, statutes we're enacting, how are we supposed to take what you're having happen and get it all the way up to a judge who's probably never been in the situations that cops have been in, just by nature of who they are as people and by nature of their jobs? If I'm the conduit in between to try to get that testimony out of you, how are we ever going to get there if I can't understand what's going on?
Right.
And I'm not saying you have to marry every cop you meet. it made understanding canine and things like that quite easier for me, but I'm always willing to have those conversations. And I think if I can tell the police that listen anything, be willing to try. So what? If a prosecutor tells you that they won't talk to you, then that's on them. But you know you tried.
Mm-hmm.
After every single trial I have, I feel confident telling, before my jury comes back, I tell my officers, I'm proud of the way you testified. I don't care what the jury says. We did what we should have done because I believe that. I'm not sitting there going, I shouldn't ask that question because you answered it in a way I didn't like. If you have that conversation, I think it puts you in a situation that you are seeking truth, you are seeking justice, and you'll likely be successful. So have the conversation.
There are really a lot of good people in the prosecutor's office and the attorney general's office that really are pro-law enforcement. No, I'm aware that there are people that aren't pro-law enforcement, even though they may be prosecutors. It's
absolutely.
I mean, look at some of these liberal cities. Larry Krasner hates mm-hmm. cops. Mm-hmm. And he's a prosecutor. The guy in New York, whatever his name is, hates the fucking cops. He just does. And it's just, it really is a constitutional disservice and a shame to watch this stuff be put on display of, if you do not believe in the same ideology that we believe in, we are going to forfeit the truth and the law and righteousness based on our political positions. It's scary.
And you can be every different kind of cop. I mean, you gave an example of you're in the police academy, and if I want to let this kid go, right? For whatever reason, as a police officer, he has a small amount of weed. I know it's a high crime area and I might have to deal with him as a witness at another point. And I want to buy myself accountability with him. I don't think he's the worst of the worst. I want to use some discretion, right? I have to deal with every cop there is. You can deal with every cop there is, but not having a conversation, that's the one thing I can't excuse, mm-hmm. right? We'll find common ground, right? You can have your own approach to the way that you choose to do your job. As long as it's not immoral or illegal,
right,
I'm sure we can find some level of commonality.
Right.
And I'm cognizant of the fact that there's prosecutors that aren't prosecutors because they should be. They're prosecutors because that's where they landed. And that's fine. But I would tell my cops, have the conversation with them, because there's good prosecutors out there.
Yeah, there is. No question about it. I mean, I've known a lot of them.
And they'll be willing to have those conversations. I don't know a good prosecutor who would say, I'm too busy for this. I'm not having this conversation.
Well, good prosecutor, right?
Yeah. Because that's the goal, right? My goal isn't just to rack up convictions. My goal is to do justice. That's the oath I take. That's the oath I have to live by. Yours is very similar as a cop. So the idea that we can't find a way to communicate is insane to me.
You know, I guess on both sides as well. And I think both sides need to acknowledge what egos are.
Absolutely.
And when I say ego is not necessarily a bad thing. But I think conceit is probably more of an appropriate, and I asked you this before we started, you know, like, why does everybody's dick grow 17 inches bigger the minute they pass the bar?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't, like, you know, I told somebody recently, I know somebody who's in medical school, and I said to her, what do you want to do in your life with your medical school degree when you graduate? And so she said, well, I want to care for people. I said, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. That's a great place to be. And that could be your moral compass. But would you also like to experience wealth? And she said, well, yes, I'd like to have that as well. I said, okay. So understand that just because you're going to be a doctor, it doesn't equal that you're going to be wealthy. It just doesn't work like that. But what you can acknowledge is that you may have to acquire some more skills beyond that you already have. And the people who are really wealthy are those who own practices.
Mm-hmm.
With that being said, The point I'm making here is just because you pass the bar doesn't mean that you're better than anybody else. Just because you pass the police academy doesn't mean you're better than anybody else. So let's like leave that shit at the door, get down to be human beings that respect one another, and then start working together. And I got to tell you, I've thought about this. Man, I feel like there is just this insecurity that they can never be wrong. They could never let, there's this thought that I'm better than you, I should know better than you, which I will say on the surface does make some sense. If you're going to be advising on the law, it would make a ton of sense for you to be better than the people who are coming to you ask for questions. But it doesn't mean you have to be. And if you're not, it's okay to say, I don't know. But don't get frustrated with us when we say, we know you don't know. We know that you're pretending that you do. And vice versa. So cops have to deploy the same kind of humility that we're asking other people to deploy. I think this is a human nature thing overall in society that you just start sucking the conceit out of everything. You probably begin to communicate quite a bit.
And I rely, and I'm just going to say this for me. If my response to an officer is because I'm a lawyer and that's why I said so.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Then it's not making sense. Now, I will admit, is there a part of being a trial attorney? Yeah, I have to walk into a room and tell 12 people, forget what that guy said. I'm right. He's wrong. Right? That's the job. But I think thinking that everyone is against me is not the case. Right? You don't know how many times I'm going over my opening with my affiants. Does this make sense? Do you like the way this is phrased? Did they go to law school? No. Are they speech majors? No. Do they listen to the same facts I listen to over and over and over and live and breathe this case? Absolutely. So tell me, what do you think of it? Or cross-examination, I turn over, do you have anything else? It takes 2 seconds. Maybe they don't. I don't expect them to. They don't have to. But maybe they do. Maybe they have something that's helpful. So I think changing that mind shift that prosecutors are over here, law enforcement is over here.
You gotta be on the same team.
We are.
You gotta be.
That's the case. And you know—
Well, sometimes we're not. We need to be.
But you know, when you walk into a courtroom, what's the defense attorney gonna call all of you? The government? The government, the this, the that. If we can't communicate as cops and prosecutors, who do you think benefits?
Well, think about some of the distrust too. Like you talked about earlier when we talked about, you know, prosecuting somebody who's falsely accusing a police officer of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
Who prosecutes cops when they're in trouble? You know, who are they scared of?
Yeah.
Attorney General's office.
Yeah.
County prosecutors, county attorneys. They're scared of them. So there's always, I think, this apprehension as we're going in that like, yeah, we're on the same team, but you're also the person that could be turned on me to come after me.
I can see that. I also, in my conversations, I think nobody hates a bad cop more than a good cop.
Unfortunately, I think that sometimes political viewpoints dictate prosecutorial, is that the right word?
Yep, prosecutorial decisions.
Decisions. And it's. I mean, we saw it in Atlanta. We had a police officer who was charged with murder for doing his job, and 2 weeks later was released and now is going to retire early and probably settle for like $11 million.
Well, I mean, I think we're talking about things in a theoretical sense, right? In a theoretical sense, prosecution and law enforcement should be on the same side. And in a theoretical sense, prosecutors should be going after law enforcement when law enforcement is not doing their job properly. It is unfortunate that in a practical sense, that's not the way it's applied.
I think when you say not doing your job properly, I always tell people, and I try to give advice to anybody who's an internal affairs person or an investigator, but namely internal affairs for this kind of conversation is, what was the intention? I think we start with that. Was this cop really meaning to do this? Did they really ignore all rules? What was the mindset of this cop when this cop did this? And so it's frustrating to see a guy like Ben Darby, who I'll bring up, he had his wife on the podcast, who was cleared on a shoot, good shoot, cleared by everybody. And then the, I don't know if there's a mayor. Or the governor, no, I think the mayor. The mayor got involved on political platform and had this police officer tried and convicted and sentenced to 30 years in prison.
And then didn't, she was just there, they
appealed, they won, he was released, yeah. And they fucked around with this guy. Like, they left him in there, like, there was no rush to get him out. I feel very badly for them. And they're going back to trial again in December. And what the judge did to them and how it was all just set up, a big system to make sure this guy got convicted. That's what they wanted the appeal on. They finally, I guess, found an appellate division set of eyes that realize what would have the job that had been done here. And it's that's the scary thing.
Yeah.
That's the terrifying thing of like of a hit job like that.
Because we, and I don't think it's something that's talked about enough. We all have a huge responsibility. I mean, when police officers swear their name to something, they can take away your rights. Same thing with prosecutors. When you sign your name, it is an affirmation of something that is way different than if someone else just happens to sign their name. And I don't know if that's lost on purpose or it just becomes routine, but I think it's something that everyone has to be very cognizant of. Doing this for 11 years, discretion is something that I learned. I think I came out and I thought, okay, the best prosecutor is the prosecutor who charges the hardest and gets the longest sentence, and that's the way that it is. I could have a victim's family that doesn't want that. And if I put them through a trial because I want my stat, who have I done a disservice to? Everyone. I haven't even done what my oath is, which is justice, if I'm so blinded by what I want. So I think we all have to have that conversation about where we are and why we're there.
Man, we have these conversations and sometimes they're not popular, but they are important in moving the needle forward to progression and resolving some of these issues. Because, you know, in today's society, I don't think anybody expects a police officer doesn't know what they're doing or talking about. They don't want a prosecutor who doesn't know what they're talking about or can't work with the cops or their family doesn't get service or justice because of personal opinions, political viewpoints. It's very frustrating because we live in a country that you would think that justice prevails. And the crazy thing is comparatively to the rest of the world, it is a place where there's a lot of systems put in place to ensure that justice does prevail. But unfortunately, at times it doesn't. And I've seen that and on both sides of the coin. You really have to put thought into where you work as a police officer and who you work for. And I think the likelihood that you may have to pull the trigger some point in your life and be reviewed and judged before you're even reviewed and judged is something you really need to think about of where you work. Because I got to tell you, I think there's places that I could tell you I probably wouldn't be a cop and places that I tell you I'd comfortably be a cop.
Isn't that wild? When in theory, it should be the same service. Right? It's interesting to me that the way things are now, you have to think about not just what you want to do, but where you should do it to be able to accomplish that
Crazy.
Goal.
Scary.
Because that's a daunting enough task already, right? To sit down and think, do I want to be a police officer? Because that's not, I'm going to try this today, right? I'm going to try whatever. I'm just going to stick my toe in the water. That's not what being a police officer is, right? Mm-hmm. Being a police officer is signing on for the fact that every time you go to a call, you don't know if somebody's going to try to kill you or not. And being comfortable with that every single day and being comfortable with the fact that you don't get to stop being, I say all the time, my husband doesn't get to stop being Officer Joe. If we're out somewhere and he yells or screams, just because he's not in his uniform doesn't mean anybody doesn't realize that wasn't Officer Joe that just did that. And that daunting task of deciding whether or not you want to take on that responsibility, that's a big enough question enough.
Mm-hmm.
So then to be able to answer that question, answer that calling, if that's what you have, right? And then have to say, now I hope I choose the right place to do it. Right? You would think the first question would be the harder one.
Mm. I've been speaking to a lot of guys that I know who have transferred to Florida. And I'll use this as an example, and to Texas as well. And, you know, I think that we become so entrenched in our own worlds that when we hear them poke fun and pick at some of the policies that we're used to up here, I think that we really are a different world in different parts of this country. And so a friend of mine went to Florida and he's like, dude, it's crazy because like we're encouraged to go be proactive. This whole agency wants proactivity. They want you stopping cars. They want you finding bad guys. They want you arresting people. They want you out there. And, you know, a lot of us in the Northeast know that that's just not the case. They don't want you being proactive. They don't want you. They're clear in what the mission objectives are here. And even sometimes when you have an agency that has a chief that is proactive and pushes proactivity, you might have a county executive or county decision makers that are not appreciative of this and will start trying to shut that shit down.
That's why I think it circles back to kind of what we were talking about with communication. And this is why. People don't know what they don't know, right? So if you don't, And I understand it's getting more popular, right? True crime podcasts, things like that. And how you testify and what you put in your affidavit is what will be disseminated and what you will be judged by, mm-hmm. right? So absolutely, report writing is crucial. Your ability to testify is crucial because that's what you will be judged on. And that's what maybe not the people on your jury, but what your average citizens are going to look at. Because maybe they don't have a friend that's in law enforcement that they're going to have these frank conversations with. You're that representative. So if you want your community to have a different approach, right? My dad had a friend who said to me, well, you do crimes against kids. Hopefully you won't have to do those forever because there's not a lot of those. And I thought, oh my God, they're underreported,
mm-hmm.
insanely so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we just got to a point that we're starting to really give sentences that I think exemplify what we're dealing with. But this is just an average citizen who likely votes, goes through everything, who just assumes it's not that big of a problem
mm-hmm.
because it's never been a problem for him. Thank God. Thank God it's never been a problem for him. But when we talk about law enforcement communicating with prosecutors and prosecutors then being able to communicate with the courts and with the public in certain ways, we have a responsibility because if not, the public doesn't know how bad things could be and what they're actually up against in a lot of ways. So I think communication is a good way of kind of bringing us together in that way too.
Mm-hmm. Man, a lot to unpack here, a lot of stuff to think about. I think, coming around full circle is let your moral compass guide you. Leave your
Absolutely.
Ego at the door, leave your conceit at the door, deploy humility, establish communication, even if it's sometimes not reciprocal, be the bigger man, woman, whatever it may be. And, be thoughtful about how important it is to train. A lot of points in this podcast that we covered.
Absolutely. I loved it.
Yeah. And I know you have to get out of here because it's 3:30 now.
I do.
Yeah. So,
thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey guys, check out our upcoming training at streetcop.com. Don't forget, we have 50 instructors nationally teaching a variety of topics. These are the best classes you're going to experience in your career. We make sure of it. You're going to love it. I guarantee you, you're going to be thankful that you went. Check us out at streetcop.com for all upcoming classes in your area.